This is WRFR Community Radio's Penobscot Bay Report. I'm Ron Huber. On September 20, 2015, while visiting Washington, D.C. for a Clean Water Network meeting, I met up with North Carolinian Steve Norris, a member of Beyond Extreme Energy. It's outside the headquarters of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, demanding a halt to the issuing of fracking permits in the United States, and in support of the call of Pope Francis for urgent action to move away from coal, oil, and gas to a renewables and energy efficiency-based economy which respects and protects our natural environment and the people.
Well, I'm in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's building at 888 First Street Northeast in Washington. I'm joining a gentleman who has been fasting here, and he's going to explain who he is and why he's doing this.
I'm Steve Norris. I live in North Carolina, in the mountains in western North Carolina. I am doing this for a whole lot of reasons, and I'm really concerned about what this earth is going to be like in 60 or 70 years when some of them are my age, and whether it's going to be livable, and whether we can sustain a human civilization of the kind we've known and been blessed by.
We're continuing to pull as much petroleum-based things out of the ground as we can, and even in the light of technology that allows us to do things besides burn our ancestors.
Right.
You know?
So, to bring more into this conversation, I see this as a war on the American people. You know, when the settlers got here in the 17th century, 16th mm-hmm. century, 17th century, there was a war on Native Americans because they felt like they needed to do that in order to find a place to settle and develop the kind of economy that we've got.
Right.
That war is not over, but they won. The people who do that kind of thing, they won. Then they turned their eyes on the rest of the world, and they did all the exploitation in the rest of the world they can do. Fortunately, a lot of those countries have become stronger and more developed and able to kind of to fight back and resist. Well, now what's left for them is to make war on this country and on the people of this country and our way of life. And of course, the cutting edge of that war is this fossil fuel tsunami that they have unleashed, especially recently, especially with natural gas. And they don't care what they have to do to communities. They don't care what they have to do to families. They're willing to do anything to install this infrastructure and yep. Create this awful paradise, I think.
Now, let me just say that I live in Rockland, Maine, on Penobscot Bay, and someone named Jim Gordon with, I forget what he calls his company, but he and his henchmen are promoting a natural gas-burning power plant with a pipeline that comes from something called the Maritimes Northeast, uh-huh. would then come down to the Maine coast,
right.
and along Penobscot Bay's coast, and then I suppose try to hook up down to Massachusetts along the coast.
It's, right.
What brought you to come to right here?
Okay, well, across the street from us, of course, is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It's little known, but it's one of the most powerful regulatory agencies in the country, maybe in the world. It has the responsibility for permitting a lot of different kinds of fossil fuel infrastructure. Not all of it, there are things, and I don't fully know what their limits are. But right now, because the major aggressive activity is in the area of expansion is around fracked gas, they are the permitting agency for all the fracked gas infrastructure that's going on in the country.
Well, they don't seem to be having any problem licensing this stuff, then.
Well, that's the thing. FERC is a rubber stamp for the fracked gas industry.
It's and like in the 1980s, I was in Oregon, but the U.S. Forest Service was the same thing.
Yeah.
Bunch of flyers.
Yeah. So.
A bunch of flyers here. Where are they?
Oh. There you go.
Thanks.
I was saying that similar to FERC then, it was the U.S. Forest Service, which was, to me, rubber stamping these sort
right.
clear cuts, one after another.
I don't know much about that. I've heard about it and so on.
But FERC is very much, they have a hard time finding any to turn down. Huh?
Yeah. From what we can tell, and of course we don't know all the information, they're permitting everything. You know, somebody looked through the records and said 97%. And the problem is they believe the lies that the energy companies sometimes tell them in order to get the permits. I work a lot with Cove Point, which is about 75 miles southeast of here on the Chesapeake Bay.
That's on the Maryland coast?
Yeah, the west coast of the Chesapeake Bay. Dominion Resources, which is a huge utility energy company headquartered in Richmond, Virginia, is building this liquid natural gas export terminal, which includes an electric power plant, because this whole thing takes so much electricity, a liquefaction facility, meaning methane has to be cooled to 260 degrees below zero for it to liquefy. And they do that because it reduces the volume of the natural gas by 80 times.
Oh, okay.
And this export terminal. And they have located this right in the middle of a residential community of about 20,000 people. However, in their permit application to FERC, they said there were only 4,000 people around the plant. And so they lied. We pointed this out to them repeatedly. They completely ignore it.
So it sounds as though, just from that one example, that money's talking and you guys might as well be mutes.
Well, we are muted. You know, for the last year, we've gone in. They have a quote-unquote open commissioners meeting once a month, mm-hmm. third Thursday of the month. We were there this last Thursday. They allow the public in, except some of us have been banned because we've gone in there before and been disruptive. But they allow the public in, but they do not allow any room for public comment. Zero.
Zero?
So you're going to make...
Not even handwritten?
Not even anything. They won't even let you hand them something. So the only way we've been able to make any points in there, sometimes we've done it with banners, sometimes we've done it with chants. Mm-hmm. This month we did it. Three or four people who had never been in before and so could get in interrupted the commissioner's meeting and made speeches of various kinds, you know, around various issues. Mm-hmm. One young woman, the best speech from my... I wasn't in there, I can't get in. But this 21-year-old woman, Bernice Tompkins, the commissioners were talking about the mitigation of forest fires. And that ticked Bernice off, and she started yelling at them. What are you doing talking about the mitigation of forest fires? You're the ones helping to cause these forest fires in the first place. If you want to mitigate them, you got to change your policies and embrace alternative energy instead of fossil fuels. You know, and she got in a minute or two of this before they dragged her out.
Oh, okay. So
it's real courage to do that. You
it
know?
Is, and however... The protesters are following the non-violence
exactly.
regime there.
That's, right.
You don't want to have that mixed it. You know, you don't want to dilute the message with that kind of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Sure.
Oh my God. And why is it that there's such a desperate effort to get the gas ripped out of the ground and then out of our country?
I think there are multiple reasons. The basic one is profit and money. Another one is I think there's a lot of denial, of course, about climate change and about the damage these things do to communities. Thirdly, I've talked to some FERC employees, and from what I can tell, they believe in climate change. They understand, at least to some extent, not the necessary mm-hmm. extent, to some extent, that this stuff is doing damage mm-hmm. to places. But they don't think there's an alternative. They are not convinced that solar and wind and energy efficiency and so on is going to solve the problem. That's been very clear to me in the few conversations I've been able to have with workers.
Well, when you say that, chap Evan, whatever his last name is, who's representing this Energy Management Incorporated in Rockland, when people said, well, that big plot of land that you want to build this plant on... couldn't this be a photoelectric solar farm
yeah,
instead?
Right.
He goes, no, you need 1,000 acres. And
right.
It was basically didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Right.
But as a sales pitcher, that's all he's got to do is disparage and then move on, I guess.
Well, you know, 8 or 10 years ago, I heard somebody, this was in North Carolina, and this was some professor, probably an engineering professor, say, mm-hmm. you know, there's enough offshore wind in this country that if we build, I don't know if it was 150,000 or 200,000 windmills, put them offshore. I live in North Carolina, mm-hmm. and there is constant 35-mile-an-hour winds. I imagine that's true in Maine.
It's true in Maine, too.
Yeah.
In fact, I've been a promoter of that, that what we've been trying to do is make sure it's at least 15 miles offshore, because there's such an intense lobster fishery and things closer
in.
There's no point in disrupting.
But these have got to be substantially far offshore anyway. I don't know all the technology on this. But in any case, if you build 150 or 200,000 windmills, you power the whole east coast, east of the Mississippi, everything, including automobiles, houses, and so on. And she also had said, made the point that in World War II, in like 1939, 1940, before the war started, the U.S. essentially had no bombers. By 1942 or 1943, we had 200,000 bombers. Now, that was with 1940s technology and construction system.
Right.
There's no reason why we couldn't do this in 10 years, you know? It just takes the political will.
And the University of Maine has been the main force between, they got the contract from, I guess it was these guys, the Department of Energy at least, to... So you became involved, as you said, through anti-war?
Anti-war and civil rights, you know. In the 70s, I moved to Boston, and I was a community organizer and did a little labor organizing as well. But I lived in an inner-city neighborhood that was under siege from all the largest hospitals in the country, as well as crime and all kinds of stuff, you know.
When you say under siege, you mean they were trying to buy up land?
They would
kick people out and take their land?
They would seize it and so on. And it was a poor neighborhood, so... And often the market values of houses was lower than the assessed for taxes. And so people sometimes were eager to sell. So we had to put up a really big fight, you know. And it became sort of the culture of the neighborhood to be fighting back, especially against the hospitals. But at the same time, as an inner-city neighborhood, there was a lot of crime and a lot of other just inner-city kind of problems. So we had to deal with all that stuff. And so it was exciting and really difficult.
And it sounds like a community united saw that it could be united about all sorts of things.
Right,
then.
Yeah. And, I mean, we were as strong a community as I think I've ever lived in, because... Mm-hmm. We had to be. This was a community of about 20,000 people, very racially diverse, and I was going to say economically diverse. They were kind of middle-class people, a lot of working-class people, a lot of young people. Rents were cheap, so in some ways it was a good place to live in that respect. And the neighborhood has survived, partly through our work.
Well, there you go. That's having a legacy like that's important.
Really good. And I learned a lot about organizing, too. Especially with these older Irish women who were defending their way of life in some ways. You know, they're really good people, very feisty.
One of the challenges we have in Maine is that most of the activists, you know, are 60 and older. It seems very difficult to get a younger generation. What do you suggest as ways to, you know, to bring younger people into these things?
I taught college recently. They booted me out because I was drawing too much attention to the college. But so I thought a lot about this, because clearly it's different than the 60s. But there are a lot of young people involved. Now, Maine or your particular place may be a little different. We have several of... the organization that's doing this thing at PERC, it's called Beyond Extreme Energy. And we've got maybe 20, 25 core people, you know, who work a lot in various aspects of this. I would say 10 of those are young people. In other words, people under 30. And the way we brought them in, it was very interesting. I mean, these are really passionate to begin with. But last year there was a walk across the country around climate issues, a great march for climate change. I don't know, our climate action. I don't know if you heard about this, but they walked from Los Angeles to D.C. And I knew one of the people who was on that walk, and he was a young guy. So I kept in touch with him, and finally I said, I'm going to go join him for a couple of weeks. So in late August, I went and joined this march, walked across Illinois, 200 miles across Illinois with him. Got to know a bunch of them, and got to talk to them about what we were doing here, because we'd already started the campaign against FERC. It was right in its beginning stages. And then we scheduled, we did a week-long set of actions starting November 1st here, and we did it at those dates because that's when their march was coming to D.C., was going to arrive in D.C. So we tied these together, and a bunch of them really got excited about what we were doing. So we brought them in, and most of them stayed. So they are core members. They actually take the lead in a lot of parts of our activity.
That's an important point there. I wonder if... I remember as a kid trying to be involved with, the Sierra Club or some others there, and it felt like there was this immense hierarchy. You'd never get to do leadership anything.
Right.
But what you're saying is you offer people the chance to take a leading role in whichever thing they are willing to take on.
We actually encourage it, and we try to make space. Like, I'm 72, I have a lot of experience. Sometimes I think I know best, but whatever, you know. But I really try to suggest, like facilitating meetings, we're bringing young people on that, or even in leading various bottom line and various things here.
Mm-hmm.
And it works, you know, and I'm not, it's a little imperfect, and there are, I'm the age of some of these people's grandfathers.
I remember the last Earth Thirst thing I went to saying, because, you know, this actions, the tree that was in 85, said, how many here were born after 1985? And almost every hand went up.
Oh, really? Really?
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah. And the other thing, I'm sure you're familiar with these terms, but, you know, out of Occupy came a whole commitment or an attempt to experiment with horizontal leadership.
Hmm.
Like, Beyond Extreme Energy has... There are always in organizations like this differences of power and responsibility and how much you get listened to and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us have voices that are more commanding and experienced and that kind of thing. But we have no designated leaders. You know,
mm-hmm.
We don't have a president. We don't have a chairperson. We don't have a board of directors either. We have this kind of core membership. But those are the ones who show up at meetings, you know.
Mm, right.
And mostly it works. It gets a little dicey when we do actions and people show up who have never been part of the organization and who may understand what they're doing but may not understand what we're doing. And so some of our meetings end up being really longer than we have time to do, because people are confused or because they don't understand the history of the organization, da-da-da. And that grates on me sometimes, because
mm-hmm.
as someone who's too busy already,
having to work with that is
tricky.
But as you said, the challenge is you want to avoid driving these folks away.
Yeah, right.
But you don't want them to... It's like, you don't... What was the name of the... fellow who let his son drive the chariot of the sun or something.
Icarus.
Icarus, yeah. You don't want to have an Icarus sort of thing happen.
Right. Yeah, that's a good metaphor. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. And because I'm an organization called Friends of Penobscot Bay, and it's very difficult to get people that are under a certain age, you know, and I've realized this is simply a weakness on my part, that we really need to, as executive director, they really need to... reach out to folks and ask them, get them involved in one way.
What about trying to, the University of Maine isn't too far from you, right?
No, it's not.
And then are there any other colleges?
Unity College is part of the University of Maine system, but it's more semi-private. But anyway, do some projects with them, but these are professor and then the students that we're working on, like checking. There's these nasty plumes from a polluter. You know, this time they want to sample the pollution. So they were asking us, what can we do that would be useful to the bay?
Uh-huh.
You know, and so that was one. But as far as the organization, that would be very important.
But maybe you could I mean, is there a 350 divestment campaign?
There's a 350 group, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe you could work with them and just go and talk to them about what you're doing. I mean, there's no guarantee. We've got 27 students from Warren Wilson College, who I taught.
Yeah.
I have connections there because I taught. Not all the students. It was 2 years ago they kicked me out. So I know some of the students. And one of them has organized 27 students to come here on Tuesday to be part of this week's activity.
Really? Okay.
Which is very cool, you know?
Yeah.
And 27, that's a big number. We're going to double our numbers here with these students. It's just for a couple of days, of course. Classes are in session and that kind of stuff.
Right, right. However, it's done. And, of course, this will be something that can change their lives.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, it does. And in the spring we had, we did a set of actions for a week in the spring. And I don't know, there were four or five students from Warren Wilson College came to that. And that week there were only six of us arrested. And one of them was one of those students.
Huh.
And it changed their life, I know. Just the fact of making a decision to get arrested, that was tricky for her.
Yeah.
And then D.C. jails are not nice places. They're really, it was the worst jail experience I've had, and I've had several, and by far the worst. And she got to be part of that, this D.C. jail system.
Oh, okay.
To see the racial disparities and opportunities, it's right on the basis. They've got LNG export in mind.
Yeah.
Because the theory is that a lot of money can be made. The problem right now is, this is true for everybody, at Cove Point and the other, the price of natural gas everywhere has plummeted. And there's an oversupply. Like, Cove Point has contracts to export to India and Japan starting in 2017. But there is a huge Australian export facility being built on the North Shore of Australia. And it's very likely that that LNG could be shipped cheaper than Cove Point's could. So there's a lot of shakiness in this whole system. And we may win because of prices, you know, and because of stock value and that kind of stuff. It all kind of works together.
So are you saying that basically the fracking technology is spread worldwide?
Yes, it's everywhere. Yeah. And the U.S. is trying to export the technology, too, like we do, like many other things.
And so the whole philosophy of instead of going, well, we have all this natural gas in the ground, won't our great-grandchildren be glad we didn't export it all?
Yeah.
Oops. Isn't there any sense of history, of looking a couple generations ahead in our economics? I guess not.
Well, we're trying to. Some of us are trying to. It's tricky because the capitalist world we live in is let's make as much money now because tomorrow we die or something. I don't know.
Right.
But it's short-term gain, and don't worry about the future. I was at a Catholic wedding one time, and it was funny. This little old priest. It wasn't a great wedding, but in any case, he talked about how this couple was responsible for their the progeny for the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. He kept going on and on about it. It got very funny. But there was this idea, and Native Americans have this, I think, more than any of the rest of us. They are responsible for future generations. We have got to look at things that way if we're going to deal with this stuff.
Look, well, thank you very much. This has been most interesting. And sort of a final thing then for just a word for people in Maine that are facing natural gas expansion. It hasn't happened yet, but the sales pitches are all in there. What are the best things they should be doing?
Talking to their neighbors. That's the place to start, right? That's where grassroots organizing begins. Talk to your neighbors. Find your neighbors who are concerned about this and who know enough to work with you, and then start trying to educate on a larger scale. When a specific project gets proposed, go to work right away to try to find out as much as you can about it, as many of the details, and it takes some geeks to kind of do that. You know, some of this stuff is really dry and technical and so on. Get as much information, and then go everywhere you possibly can through letters and attending hearings and all of that, and make as big a stink as you can for as long as you can. Now, it's very tricky because one of the things I've learned dealing with FERC is that the regulators, most regulators, and maybe being a smaller state and so on, may be better, but most of the regulatory agencies at the federal level and the state level are designed not to regulate industry. They're designed to regulate the public. So what they do is they give, they have these hearings. I've been to a couple of hearings in North Carolina or by the Department of Public Utilities around proposals by Duke Energy, which is the largest utility in the country. So we show up with 150 people who are opposed to the project. Either nobody speaks at the hearing, or in one case, two people spoke at the hearing against Duke, and Duke gets its way. That's the way our regulatory. What they do is they give an illusion of democracy, they give an illusion of public input, and then they.
Well, were those 100 people given an opportunity to speak?
Oh, yeah. There wasn't time for all of them, but maybe 90 or 100 of us spoke. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there was an opportunity to speak. But words don't have any power. Well, I shouldn't say that. I think words do have power in the right place, but if they've made their decisions already.
This is just window dressing for them.
So it's very tricky. So ultimately, to win some of these battles, we've got to be willing to use nonviolent civil disobedience and other things, which you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. You know, that can be a real stretch for some people who have never done this stuff before. On the other hand, it can be very exciting and interesting, a great way to develop solidarity and community.
Right. Some of the, I call them the eco-yuppies in our area, are terrified of that sort of thing.
Right. And I work in Cove Point, and there are probably five or six residents of Calvert County who have been willing to take that step. Hmm. But most people, even people who oppose the plan, are not willing to take that step.
They're afraid
for all kinds
of
reasons.
They're afraid of sticking your hand into the machine's jaw and it pulls you. And
they don't want to go to jail. They don't want their reputation. Some people, young people, some of them, are very concerned about job prospects later on. And that's a legitimate concern. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in a world.
Right. Unless you've got some personal, some trade or something that doesn't require that. Right. There's someone, I don't know if you ever met Jimmy Freeman. He's a Maine activist. And he's been arrested so many times, I can't even imagine how many. But he's very good organized from the sense that, you know, before the event happens, we've talked with the police, they know what's going to happen. And it's not an effort to go and rumble and wreck and anarchistically whack things and so on. Right. And so all these events have been, even with arrests and so on, very well covered, but also not marred by the sort of violence that takes the message away.
And that's what we've done here. We had, in the fall and the spring, we had a week-long set of actions here in the fall. We had 10 days of actions here, just continuous pressure, blocking the entrances and so on. And we had a total, somewhere around 75 arrests here, of the kind you're talking about. We have good relationship with, this is Homeland Security, Department of Protective Services. They know who we are, we know who they are, they know we will not be violent, and so on. And so that's worked well.
Good. And there hasn't been a provocateur sort of thing?
Not yet. I hope not.
All right. So you are in a fast right now, and just water?
Just water. Water only. I put half a lemon in hot water in the morning and drink a cup of hot tea. That's it.
And so on. Are you prepared to go until either your message is received or?
No, we intended to do this for 18 days, and so we started on September 8th. We're finishing it at noon on September 25th, this Friday. We chose those dates because the Pope Francis, who has made a very strong statement about climate change and racial, economic, and social justice. Is going to give a speech at Congress on Thursday, the 24th. And so we partly did our fast at this time to try to amplify his message and bring his message directly to FERC. And on Friday, as part of the ending of the fast, we are going to attempt, we've got clergy working with us on this, to deliver five copies of his book, which is called the encyclical, or the formal name is Laudato Si. We're going to attempt to deliver 5 copies of that to the 5 Kirk commissioners. We sent a letter to Norman Bay, the head of the commissioners, asking him to formally accept these. Whether he does or not, I don't know. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't, that's newsworthy. If he does, it's newsworthy. So it would be a great way to follow up on the Pope's visit.
For more information, contact www.beyondextremeenergy.org.